Hi there. My name is Matt Walker. I am a professor of neuroscience and psychology, and I'm also a sleep scientist. I think many of us understandably think of sleep as perhaps a cost or even a waste of time. However, sleep is not a cost, but instead, sleep is an investment. And it's an investment in your health, your productivity, your lifespan, even your health span. In fact, sleep is perhaps the single most effective thing that we can do each and every day to reset the health of our brain and our body. What most of you may be asking are at least two questions. What then is good sleep? And perhaps as importantly, exactly how can I try to maximize my chances of getting whatever it is that you tell me is this thing called good sleep? Well, I'm glad you ask. Let us dive in. And let's start with what good sleep is. There are four macros of good sleep. Just like there are three macros of food, fat, protein, carbohydrate, well, when it comes to sleep, there are four macros, the four macros of good sleep. And you can remember it by the acronym QQRT. QQRT. And it stands for quantity, quality, regularity, and timing. When it comes to the four macros of good sleep, you can really think about it like four legs of a chair. And if one leg is weak or missing, the entire structure becomes unstable. And therefore, addressing all four together ensures the solid foundation we all need for great sleep. So let's explore each one of these macros in detail. Let's start with quantity. You've all heard of this. This used to be the single metric of good sleep. How much sleep do you need? Based on the data right now, for most adults, it will range between 7 to 9 hours. We certainly know that once you get less than 7 hours of sleep, it is associated with increased risks of mortality, cognitive decline, immune dysfunction, and chronic illnesses such as heart disease and diabetes. And by the way, I should also note that more isn't always better. What we do see is that once you get past about 10 hours or so of sleep a night, it can sometimes signal that if you're needing 10 hours of sleep and you have an underlying condition, that may be a signal of perhaps a sleep disorder or some other form of chronic fatigue. But if you are medically healthy and you feel as though you need 10 hours of sleep, then that's just fine as well. So there is the measure of quantity. Let me then come on to the second of the Qs, quality. And here, what I mean by quality is two different measures. The first measure is the continuity. Are you sleeping soundly across the night with very few awakenings? That's good quality sleep. But if you're waking up many times and your night is littered with all of these awakenings, we think of that as low efficiency sleep because you're awake for so much of the night. That is not good quality of sleep. And you'll see in some of your sleep trackers that measure of quality called sleep efficiency. Sleep efficiency is simply of the time that you're in bed, what percent of that time is spent asleep? And we like to see that your sleep efficiency is at least 85% or higher. The second measure of quality is something that you can't typically get from these sleep trackers, but you can measure in places like My Sleep Center, where we place electrodes on your head and we can look at the size of the big, slow, deep brain waves during deep, non-rapid eye movement sleep. And we have two stages of sleep, by the way, rapid eye movement sleep, which is associated with dreaming, and then we have non-rapid eye movement sleep. And we have light non-REM sleep and deep non-REM sleep. And during deep non-REM sleep, another metric of quality is how big and powerful those deep, slow brain waves are. Now, let's come on to the third macro. R stands for regularity. And what I mean here is go to bed at the same time and wake up at the same time. No matter whether it's the weekday or the weekend, regularity is king, and it will improve both the quantity and the quality of your sleep, Because when you feed your brain and its 24-hour clock these signals of regularity, that's when it will start to improve the two cues that we've spoken about, as I mentioned, quantity and quality. There was a very fascinating study that came out of a data set called the UK Biobank, and it involved over 60,000 individuals. And what they found was that people with the most consistent sleep schedules, where their wiggle room time from maybe going to sleep versus waking up was so consistent weekday and weekend, perhaps within 20 minutes or so, those people had a 49% reduced risk of mortality compared to those that were highly irregular. And in fact, the regular sleepers also had a 35% reduction in dying from cancer and also a 60% lower risk of dying from cardiovascular related mortality. And what these data suggest is that maintaining a regular sleep pattern is perhaps one of the most protective things that you can do to improve not only your lifespan, but also your health span. Many of us want to live as long as we can, but also many of us want to live for as long as we can without disease and sickness. That's your health span, and that's where regularity is absolutely critical. The final of the four macros stands for timing, and you may think, hang on a second, timing sounds like regularity. Well, it's different. Timing refers to the alignment of your sleep schedule with your natural biological 24-hour clock. This is called your chronotype. Your chronotype determines whether you are naturally a morning person, an evening person, or somewhere in between, a neutral. And approximately one-third of the population falls into these categories. So it's about a one-third, one-third, one-third split across morning types, evening types, and neutral types. I have some good news for the evening types. It's not your fault, because it turns out that your chronotype is largely genetically determined. It's gifted to you at birth. There are at least 22 different genes that will dictate your morningness or your eveningness. And therefore, it's not a choice, and you can't be labeled as being slothful or lazy, just as we mentioned before, because it is genetically determined. It turns out that we have a finer separation of chronotype in sleep science. We'll split it into five groups. We've got extreme morning types, neutrals, evening types, and extreme evening types. What does that mean? Well, extreme morning types have a genetic tendency to be going to sleep, let's say, from about 8 o'clock in the evening and waking up maybe at 4 or 4:30 a.m. in the morning, and they operate just fine at that time. Morning types prefer to sleep from about 9:30 p.m. to about 5:30 a.m. Neutrals like to sleep at around about 10:30, 11 through until about 7:30 a.m. in the morning. The evening types, perhaps 12:30 a.m. to 9 a.m. And then the extreme evening types, they can be wanting to fall asleep from 2:30 a.m. or even later, and then sleeping through until 10:30 a.m. or later. That's their natural tendency. So an extreme evening type, when they are forced by society to sleep like even just a morning type or even a neutral, is going to be incredibly hard for them. We'll often have people come to my sleep center and they'll say, look, I've got terrible sleep onset insomnia that I get into bed and I'm wide awake for the first 2 hours and then I fall asleep. And we do a chronotype test with them where we can assess, are you an extreme morning type, a neutral, evening type, or an extreme evening type? And we find out that they are an evening type. They like to go to bed maybe around 12, 12:30. But because of the way society is forcing them to sleep, they're getting into bed at 10 p.m. Well, it turns out they don't have insomnia. They just have a mismatch between their chronotype and when they're forcing their body and their brain to get into bed and try to sleep. And that's why it's so important to understand your chronotype, because it can explain so much about yourself. And if you want to assess your chronotype, you don't have to do a genetic test. You can just go online and type in Morningness Eveningness Questionnaire, or MEQ for short, and it takes about 3 or 4 minutes, and it gets you very close to your genetics, and it will tell you which type you are. So those are the four macros of good sleep: QQRT, quantity, quality, regularity, and timing. And they offer a structure for understanding what good sleep is, but they don't tell you how to get good sleep. So then, what can you do to optimize your sleep? Let me try to give you a brief guide on what science teaches us about optimizing your sleep. And the best framework I can think of is actionable steps that are categorized into two main buckets. The first bucket is things to do more of. The second bucket is things to do less of or to avoid entirely. And as you'll see, this approach integrates both external environmental factors, internal body regulation, behavioral strategies, and even, when necessary, changing what we take into our body in terms of pharmacology. So let's start with bucket number one, things to do more of in terms of optimizing your sleep. Well, number one, the best piece of advice I could give you here, we've actually already discussed, which is to prioritize regularity. Maintaining a consistent sleep schedule isn't just one of the four macros of good sleep. It will retrain your body clock. And by feeding your body clock these signals of consistent night after night, morning after morning, no matter, again, whether it's the weekday or the weekend, it will help re-entrain your circadian rhythm. It's almost like having a slightly faulty wristwatch. And by feeding it signals of regularity, it's like popping the dial out on the side of your wristwatch. And regularity signals act like these fingers, and they just reset your 24-hour circadian clock, and it will help you fall asleep more consistently and wake up more easily when you're giving it those signals of regularity. So as I said, try to go to bed at the same time and wake up at the same time. Now, there's no need to be puritanical and dictatorial. You don't need to be like me, where you're almost doing it within 5 to 10 minutes of wiggle room. My goodness, don't worry about idiots like me. What I would say is that think about a wiggle room of about 20 minutes either side of a specific wake-up time. So try to go to bed within about 20 minutes of the same time, and try to wake up within about 20 minutes of the same time. The next suggestion of what to do more of is get morning light exposure. Morning light exposure helps regulate your circadian rhythm by signaling to your brain it's time to wake up. It will also stamp the brakes on the release of a hormone called melatonin. Now, we'll speak about melatonin again when we speak about creating a sleep-friendly environment, but by the time you're waking up in the morning, now we want to shut down melatonin production. Whereas in the evening, we want to ramp it up. And to place the brakes on melatonin, we need daylight. What to do here as an action item: try to spend at least 10 to 15 minutes outside in natural daylight within the first hour or 2 hours of your waking day, if that's possible. And for many people, that's not possible. Try to do the best job that you can. Even if it's just sitting or standing next to a window when you're reading your phone in the morning, because we all do that, or having a cup of coffee, try to get some daylight exposure. Windows will diffract the light and they will reduce its power to stamp the brakes on melatonin, but it's still going to help some. And people in the extreme north and south latitudes will also use a light box to try to help that light get to them in the morning, especially in their respective winters when they're not getting a lot of light. And why all of this works is that it not only helps anchor your internal clock by giving it signals of daylight and not just regularity, it will also help with your back-end ability to fall asleep at night at the right time. And when you fall asleep at the right time, it also enhances the quantity and the quality of your sleep. So think about your night of sleep starting from the moment that you wake up in the morning during the day. Number three, create a sleep-friendly environment. And there are several tips here. Number one, keep it cool. Your brain and your body need to drop their core temperature by about 1 degree Celsius or about 2 to 3 degrees Fahrenheit for you to fall asleep and stay asleep soundly. So aim for a bedroom temperature of somewhere between about 64 to 67 degrees. I know it sounds cold, but cold it must be. It's the reason that you will always find it easier to fall asleep in a room that's too cold than too hot. The cold room is taking you in the right temperature direction for good sleep. The hot room, it goes in the opposite. That's why it's such a struggle. I would say that for people in their 70s, you may want to keep the bedroom just a little bit warmer. You could go up to maybe 68 or 70 degrees. But for most of us who are not in our older ages of life, there we're aiming for a bedroom temperature, really somewhere between 65 to 67 degrees. Next up, in the evening, unlike what we're doing in the morning with bright daylight, we need to do the opposite in the evening. We are a dark-deprived society in this modern era, and we need darkness at night to release that hormone of melatonin to help with the timing of your sleep. So in the last hour before bed, set an alarm, and when that alarm goes off, dim down half of the lights in your house. You will be surprised at how sleepy and soporific that darkness will make you feel. The other environmental factor here is quiet. If you find that you are in an environment that's noisy, try to use earplugs. You can use a white noise machine, and there are certain apps that you can use to sort of recreate a white noise machine-like sound. You can use brown noise. Some people have also used pink noise. We don't have great data right now on which of the colors of noise are the most optimal, but certainly you can use some kind of a noise machine, but also using earplugs is going to be a critical help there. The next tip is not about measuring your external environment, but measuring your psychological and physiological internal environment. What I mean here is helping you manage your stress and anxiety. Stress and anxiety are perhaps the major disruptors of sleep. It's led to this tired but wired phenomenon. People say, I am so tired, I'm so desperately tired, but I'm so wired that I can't fall asleep. What do we do to try to help with that stress and anxiety at night? Well, we have a number of practices in sleep medicine that we use. Things like meditation and mindfulness. There are apps out there such as Calm and Headspace and lots of other great meditation apps that give guided meditations for sleep. You can also do a body scan in terms of relaxation. You can start at the top of the head and you can walk yourself down thinking about each and every part of your body, and you can gradually relax the neck. You can let go of your forehead. You can start to relax down the shoulders. Then you can start to breathe nice and deeply, going all the way out, just pushing your belly out and bringing it back down in, just this nice diaphragmatic breathing. Anything like that is going to help wind down the body's nervous system and wind down the mind. If you don't like any of those, you can try box breathing. You can inhale for 4 seconds, hold it for 4 seconds, and then exhale for 4 seconds, and then repeat it. And there's lots of different versions of box breathing. You can inhale for 3, you can hold for 5 or 6, and then you can exhale for 5. Lots of different versions. But box breathing is another way that you can help regulate the body back down to being quiet in its nervous system, and that helps quiet the mind. The other two suggestions. First, about 2 hours before bed, just try to write down all of your worries on a page and then finish it with 5 or 6 positive thoughts, even just 2 or 3 positive thoughts. So to begin with, I just want you to vomit out, like catharsis, all of your worries onto the page, and then end with positive things about your day. And that way, it's been demonstrated that you can speed the time it takes for you to fall asleep by almost 50%. You can reduce it down by half by doing these worry journals. Finally, if you've woken back up in the middle of the night and you can't get back to sleep, meditation, box breathing, they're all great, but some people don't find them attractive. The other thing that's been proven in science is go on a hyper-vivid mental walk. Imagine a walk that you do consistently. Maybe it's a walk with the dog. And I want you to recollect that walk in incredible detail. So I'm going to open the drawer and I'm going to pick out which leash of the two, the blue or the red one. I'll take the blue one this time. I clip in the dog with my right hand. I open the door with the left hand. I go down the stairs. That level of detail. Because what's striking about every one of these techniques is that they have something in common. All of them are designed to get your mind off itself, because that's the problem in the modern world with stress and anxiety when it comes to sleep. Because when we are in the modern era, we're constantly on reception. Very rarely do we do reflection. And the time when we do reflection is when our head hits the pillow, and that's the worst time for us to do reflection. So what we need to do is try to get the mind off itself, because if we don't, the Rolodex of anxiety begins. And when it starts turning, we start to ruminate. And when we ruminate, we catastrophize, and everything feels twice as bad in the dark of night than it does in the light of day. And by getting your mind off itself using these techniques, it's a little bit like trying to remember someone's name. You know, the harder you try, the further you push it away. And it's the same with sleep. The harder you try, the more it goes away from you. The moment you stop trying, that's the moment when the name comes back to you. And it's a little bit like that with sleep, that when you use these techniques, the next thing that you remember is your alarm going off in the morning, because you got your mind off itself. Let's finally come on to things to avoid, do less of, or to at least minimize. Number one, caffeine. I know. Caffeine is what we call a psychoactive substance, and everyone knows that caffeine is something that keeps you awake. But caffeine does this in a very interesting way. From the moment that you woke up this morning, a chemical has been building up in your brain. That chemical is called adenosine. The more that builds up, the sleepier you feel. Adenosine is a chemical that we call sleep pressure. And the longer that you've been awake, the more adenosine that builds up, the more that builds up, the sleepier you will feel. And after about 16 hours of being awake, you should have plenty of adenosine weighing you down on your shoulders so that you fall asleep effectively and stay asleep. But the problem with caffeine is that it races in, and it essentially hits the mute button on adenosine, because caffeine will bind to the welcome sites, what we call the receptor sites of adenosine in the brain. But when it latches onto the receptors, it doesn't stimulate them and make you more sleepy. It simply blocks them. And therefore your brain is fooled into thinking there isn't as much adenosine around anymore. I was feeling sleepy, but all of a sudden the sleepiness signal has just gone away. Why? Because caffeine has blocked the receptors, and the sleepiness signal can no longer tell the brain that you've been awake for that long, so you feel alert. The other thing about caffeine to be mindful of is that it has a half-life. A half-life is simply the time it takes for about half of whatever you've taken into your body to be degraded. And caffeine has a half-life of about 5 to 6 hours for the average adult. That means it has a quarter life of 10 to 12 hours. So let's say that you have a cup of coffee at noon. It could be that if you're the average adult, a quarter of that caffeine is still in your brain at midnight. And we don't often think that that's the reason why we're struggling to sleep, which is that we had a cup of coffee at noon. But that's what happens with the dynamics of how caffeine sticks around in your system. So what's the action item here? I would try to say, no harm, no foul. Lean into caffeine. Coffee has got lots of health benefits. By the way, it's not to do with the caffeine. It's because they provide lots of antioxidant benefits from the coffee bean itself. That's why coffee drinking is associated with health benefits, not because of the caffeine. But I would say enjoy your cup of coffee or several cups of coffee. Just try to cut yourself off after about midday, assuming, let's just say, the average bedtime for most adults. Also, just keep in mind, other things have caffeine in them too. Energy drinks have lots of caffeine in them. Dark chocolate can contain significant amounts of caffeine. Even some pain medications can contain caffeine. Advice, read the label when it comes to caffeine. Next up, try to limit your alcohol intake. Many people think of alcohol as a sleep aid. It is anything but a sleep aid. Alcohol is in a class of drugs that we call the sedatives, and sedation is not sleep. But when you have a couple of nightcaps in the evening, you mistake the former for the latter. And alcohol is harmful for your sleep in at least three ways. First, as I said, it produces a state of sedation. And if we look at your electrical brainwave signature with versus without alcohol, it doesn't look like natural sleep. The second thing is that alcohol is very good at fragmenting your sleep. Remember from our four principles, the four macros of good sleep, QQRT, quantity, quality, regularity, and timing. We spoke about how important quality was. Well, alcohol will fragment your sleep. You wake up many more times throughout the night. The problem is that you don't commit those awakenings to memory, so you don't remember waking up many times throughout the night with alcohol. So you never put two and two together. But alcohol will decrease your sleep efficiency because you're waking up so many times throughout the night. The final problem with alcohol is that it's very good at blocking your dream sleep or your REM sleep. And REM sleep is essential for things like your emotional and your mental health. It's important for even your learning and memory association abilities, creativity. But downstairs in the body, it's during REM sleep when we release our peak levels of testosterone, both men and women. We all need testosterone, just in different amounts. And if you're not getting that sufficient REM sleep, you're going to be losing out on those functions. The other thing I should obviously speak about is cannabis. And here, when we split it down into its two component main parts, we're talking about THC and CBD. THC has been really demonstrated by the science as, currently at least, not being ideal for your sleep. THC certainly makes you fall asleep faster. The problem with THC is that you start to build up a dependency, you start to build up a tolerance, so you need to take more to get the same benefit. The second problem with THC is that it's very good at blocking your dream sleep. And this is why frequent marijuana users, people who just smoke weed a lot, will say to you, goodness, you know, I don't really remember my dreams. And if they stop using THC or they stop smoking, all of a sudden they'll say, I was having these crazy wild dreams. Why? Well, because the THC had been blocking your dream sleep for so long that your brain had built up this massive REM sleep debt. And then finally, when you stopped smoking or using THC, your brain tried to get back the REM sleep that it had lost. So you have this really intense REM sleep. That's why we have a REM sleep intense rebound and very intense rebound dreaming when you stop using THC. The other problem with THC, by the way, is that when you stop using, you typically go back to not only having the bad sleep that you had before, but it's typically worse. It's called rebound insomnia. And in fact, that insomnia that you suffer when you stop smoking is the leading reason why most people can't sustain their attempt at abstinence and have to restart using again, because they just can't take the severity of the insomnia rebound. So it's this terrible vicious cycle that one gets themselves into. CBD, I think the data is less clear on right now. I don't think there's enough data to favor it or to reject it. There is some early evidence that higher concentrations of CBD, and if you squint your eyes and look at the data, and there's just not enough data to make any consistent suggestion here, but perhaps if you look at it, it may be north of about 50 milligrams, but as I said, there's no consensus here. That may be sleep beneficial. The problem is that once you get less than about 25 milligrams, CBD may be wake promoting. And so you're doing yourself a disservice by way of taking in lower dose CBD. But again, we just don't have any clear data. Don't take that as a hard and fast rule. It's not even a rule of thumb. So I would say the jury is out on CBD, but certainly I think sleep medicine currently does not advocate for the use of THC as a sleeping aid, at least not right now. We may come up with analogs, which is a simply fancy way of saying slightly different chemical structures that are not dissimilar to THC that have some of the sleep benefits, but without some of the REM sleep disruption drawbacks, without some of the development of tolerance and therefore dependency, and also without some of the rebound insomnia that happens. I think that would be a fabulous place to get to. Why throw the baby out with the bathwater? Again, I don't want to be puritanical here. Nobody wants to be the healthiest person in the graveyard. I don't want to be. Joie de vivre, live a little bit. So every now and again, have some alcohol, but I'm simply giving you the scientific data so that you can be empowered to make your own decisions when it comes to how you want to regulate your life and how you want to optimize your sleep. The final thing I would note is perhaps focusing on trying to eat L-I-T-E in the last couple of hours before bed. Eating large meals close to bedtime, certainly within the last 2 hours of sleep, can interfere with your sleep process in a number of ways. The first and the most obvious is that you get acid reflux. And that can lead to heartburn, and it can cause you an awakening or multiple awakenings throughout the night. The second is that if you eat too much food close to bed, you will increase your core body temperature. And that increase in core body temperature, even just by a couple of decimal places of Celsius, can lead to a disruption in both the quantity and the quality of your sleep. Therefore, those two of the four critical macros. So, what would be the advice here? Try to cut yourself off from at least heavy meals 2 hours before bed. Opt for a light snack if you need it. And try to stay away from simple sugars and try to lean into something that's perhaps protein rich or fiber rich at that point in time. There is one thing that I still need to mention. If you are suffering from a sleep disorder such as sleep apnea or restless leg syndrome or from insomnia or one of the many other sleep disorders out there, I would encourage you to try to see if you could get a diagnosis, because none of what I've just described in terms of optimizing human sleep is going to help you if you have a sleep disorder. It's a little bit like me saying, I'm going to work with an athlete and I'm going to give them all of these tips to optimize their performance. But if the athlete has a broken ankle, no amount of the recommendations or the tips that I've just described are going to help you until we get you to a doctor and we get the broken ankle fixed. So in conclusion then, how does this all work if we put it together? Well, I would suggest something along the following lines is an excellent blueprint manifesto to sleep optimization, focusing on the four macros. Quantity, aim for 7 to 9 hours a night. Quality, try to stay away from things that are going to hurt your sleep quality, like caffeine and alcohol. And then try to lean into the things that improve your sleep continuity, like keeping your bedroom nice and cool, making it a quiet environment, and avoiding heavy meals close to bedtime. All of those things can help either reduce down the chances of it being fragmented or improve the chances of nice, long, continuous bouts of sleep. The next up is regularity. Not just going to bed and waking up at the same time, but helping yourself with that. Many of us set a wake-up alarm, but we should have two alarms at least. We should have a to-bed alarm and a wake-up alarm. In fact, if you want to think about me and my sleep, I will admit to having three alarms. I'll have an alarm that goes off an hour before bed. That's when I dim down most of the lights in the house or turn most of them off. Then I'll have an alarm that says, okay, whatever you're doing, let's say you're reading, listening to a podcast, now it's time to go to bed. And it helps inform me that it's time and I really can't sleep procrastinate as sometimes even I wish I could do. And then my wake-up alarm. And when we speak about regularity, here we're really talking about a maximum wiggle room of about 20 minutes either side. The final of the four macros is timing. Try to align your sleep schedule as best you can. And of course, I'm talking here about all of the ideal world of sleep. And none of us live in the ideal world. We all live in the real world. And I understand that we've got work pressures, kids to get to school, all sorts of, we want to spend time with the family, with our significant other. Maybe we like to watch entertainment in the evening. All of these things compete for our nighttime sleep hours. But I would simply say, try to align your sleep schedule as best you can with your natural chronotype, having done a chronotype test. And if you can, try to match it within about 30 minutes or so. That will improve the quantity and the quality of your sleep. Lastly, we spoke about the do's and the don'ts. We spoke about external factors like getting morning light in the first 1 to 2 hours, staying cool at night in your bed, staying dark, not just in the last hour before bed, but make your bedroom like a cave, cold, dark, and quiet. And we spoke about minimizing the sleep disruptive substances that we take into our body, things like caffeine and alcohol. We also spoke about things that are internal, inside of our mind, that can disrupt our sleep, more specifically stress and anxiety, and thinking about ways and techniques to reduce those, things like meditation, doing body scans, doing box breathing, and even taking yourself on a mental walk. So what would I like to leave you with in terms of a take-home message here? Well, I would say that based on all of the scientific data, when sleep is abundant, minds and bodies flourish. And when it is deficient, they don't. In fact, sleep is the Swiss Army knife of health. No matter what ailment that you're suffering, it's more than likely that sleep has a tool in its box to try to help out. In fact, I would almost go as far to say that sleep is perhaps nature's best effort yet at immortality. So I hope all of this has helped, even just a little bit. And if I've missed anything that you found powerful in your own lives in terms of sleep optimization, please leave it in the comment section. I will read all of your contributions. And if you want to find out more about me, you can simply listen to my podcast. It is creatively called The Matt Walker Podcast. You can find it on all podcast channels. And you can also find me all over the typical social channels. I won't bore you with my handles, but you'll be able to find me. And with all of that said, I will simply wish you a good night. Take care. Sleep well. Bye for now.